Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're here for another episode of the Spoolcast, and today I have the amazing Nathan Curtis, who has come to us before. Over the years, we've been talking to him about design patterns and modular reusable components, and today we're going to talk about scalable design systems and style guides, and it's a coincidence that he's also going to be talking about that at our UI 20 conference that's going to be in November 2nd through 4th. He's going to do a full-day workshop, which just coincidentally is called Building Scalable Design Systems and Style Guides, and today that's what we're going to talk about. Hey, Nathan, how are you?
Good, Jared. Good to talk to you again.
Nathan will be presenting one of the day-long workshops at the User Interface 20 conference November 2nd through 4th in Boston. For more information, visit uiconf.com.
Good to talk to you. When we first started talking years and years ago, we were talking a lot about components. And then we got into pattern libraries. And then somewhere in the process, I remember us talking about style guides. And now it's design systems. And is this just a change in the marketing, or are these things actually different from one another?
Oh, I'd characterize them as fairly different and synonymous with the expansion of design within the enterprise, because when I think about the simplest thing that preceded my work in the industry, really, was style guides. You think about print style guides, and it's the establishment of the base visual language that a company has, or if some organization wants to project the color, the typography, the logo, the tone, the essence of the brand. Oftentimes, those things are comprised in a style guide, and even that is a label can overlap with other people's work, particularly like technical communicators or editors that have an editorial style guide that oftentimes gets lumped in or confused with those two things. But as a designer, UX designer, I work a lot with creating layouts and the structure and the navigation and threading it all together in a cohesive experience. And so I think a lot about all the parts that I have at my disposal. And that's where the term library comes to mind. You know, you have a library of design patterns, like a sign-in pattern or a search pattern or whatever the pattern might be, but all the real tangible parts too, the buttons, the form controls, and all the components that you have to modularly build web pages in my history or types of applications. And so oftentimes style guide refers to a core part or a foundation of the library of parts that everybody has at their disposal. And people have been building those for years. You know, it's been 10 years since I worked with the Sun.com team, and they had a massive component library. So all these component libraries aren't new, but they are starting to get used by more and more people. And so when you start to think about all the people that participate in that and all the products that they apply these things to, suddenly you have to think more systematically. And that's where the term design system comes from. You think about the relationships that those people have, and you think about the platforms and different parts of the experience and the devices that these products apply to, and suddenly you're weaving together a complex threaded system of things that you need to maintain. Suddenly the parts need to be more broadly applicable, like a button and how a button appears in all of these different contexts. And so thinking about it like a component, suddenly a person making a web application thinks, okay, that's a library of things. I'm going to take the code, I'm going to inject it right into my experience, and it's just a component that I can reuse over and over again. But the system is the practice and the way that those people participate and the way that you ultimately need to consider how that's going to play out over time because of how complicated it gets and all of those interchangeable parts, not just of the experience, but of how the work gets done.
Having that sort of larger system, it feels to me like that's going to involve more people, more discussion, getting more sort of different opinions onto the same page. How is it that teams grow into that in such a way that doesn't feel like suddenly you're mired in crazy politics?
Well, there's always going to be politics. And a way to flip that around and talk more positively about it is that you need to talk about alignment. Larger scale digital design organization is going to have a bevy of different products, and designers are going to be working across all those different products. And so part of the alignment that you need to have is aligning the vision of how those different designers are thinking, not just about the stories that their product teams are working on in each sprint, but also about how the pieces that they're designing fit with the pieces that all of the other designers are working on. One of the things that I've seen a number of companies do really effectively is cherry pick a set of core designers that effectively get partitioned off into this design system team. They're still participating with their product teams. They're still leaders more often than not in the organization. They have some legitimacy associated with them, but they're also a cross-section. For example, one team divided it out by discipline. They cherry-picked an experienced designer, a visual designer, someone who is really strong in interaction and motion, and then someone who is really strong with content. And so you had this cross-disciplinary feel within the design organization of those different considerations. And they also happen to be a lot of the leaders. And they were the people that would employ and engage with other members of the design organization that would influence it over time or contribute different pieces to it. Like this person does the iconography on the motion designers team, whereas somebody else is working on color because they're part of the visual designers team. And so you have these different designers that you need to work with. I think the other part of the alignment that's more difficult is aligning with the other disciplines outside the consideration of design, particularly the developers that want to reuse different pieces in different ways. You have the product managers that you really need to work with to convince that the design system and the application of a cohesive experience and making things more usable isn't another separate thing they need to do to replace features in their backlogs, but instead those are features in their backlog. And then finally, working outside of the product groups that are creating products, but more aligning with the brand team and with other organizations, maybe marketing outside the space of those building digital products. And so it does get complicated, but the best thing that I've seen those teams do is identify a core set of individuals, even when they're starting, even when they're a bit undercover, even when they're just trying to seed that system with something to start from, identifying usually the team is around 4 to 6 people that start building something from the ground up.
Is this a centralized activity, or do you have clients who are doing this sort of by committee with representation from all the different groups? What's that sort of governance?
So it depends on where they're at or what moment in time they're at, because I have rarely seen success in a company saying, we need a design system, and one doesn't exist, none of their designers are working together, and suddenly they need to carve it out as this specific investment that's going to detract from their ability to deliver product. I've never seen it work that way. I've actually seen it work better when you have this formative stage, when you have a small group that care about it a lot, are passionate enough about it, can show some results, and maybe start to get some top-down executive buy-in, but it's more undercover. It's more across products in a way that isn't really engaging something to deliver immediately. But then they start to build that story. And by the time they start to spread it around to everybody else, they have artifacts that demonstrate how this system works, some sort of proof of concept or journey or set of prototypes. They have documentation of how it's supposed to work. They have essentially the conversations with the product teams where they're starting to deliver stuff. Then the conversation turns into, is this sort of an enterprise service? Is it horizontal across the design teams? Is this something that we need to carve out half time of a certain array of designers to form a team that is more persistent? Because once they get into that mode where they have all these artifacts and they have all this energy, suddenly they need to start treating it like a product. And that design system itself is something that might have a roadmap, it might have a backlog of things they're going to do, it might have a specific person managing that backlog and really projecting out what that vision is. Essentially, the design system itself internally as a service has a product manager to think about it. But that's later stage. That's when they're in that sustaining mode. That's when they've actually built something and it's really starting to grow and evolve. But nobody starts there.
Yeah, so I could see this as sort of this, I need a bunch of reusable components for me, so I build those, and you know, I'm working with a bunch of other folks, and they like it, so we start building it for ourselves, and now we're starting to think about, okay, there are other groups that could use this. It feels like it could go a couple ways. It could just be sort of, hey, we're going to put this out for people to use, and if you use it, great, and if you don't, you know, that's okay too, or it's going to be mandated across the organization and people have to start to think about switching to it. Do you see those different approaches happening? And if so, what tends to happen when they choose one or the other?
I think you need to broaden your spotlight, because I don't think either of those approaches are the best approach. The first one that ends up being a really negative approach is a mandate, coming out with some design system that everybody has to use. It's massive. It's sort of monolithic. And it's created by, admittedly, hopefully a representative subset of people. But to all the other people that didn't have a voice, they won't see it as legitimate. And so mandating, particularly early on, isn't going to work really well. The other thing that I have sensed doesn't get as much traction is when people build things for themselves and then just open it up for other people to use if they want to. Because think about platforms. If you're designing for a web-based marketing site and you have all these web-based products and you have all these Android and iOS apps and you might have a bunch of Windows apps that you also sell to your customers that are embedded in things like SQL Studio, you know, all these things that don't necessarily carry through all of the aspects of the core design language, for example, but could still benefit from aspects of the system. All these other people are going to dismiss you if they're like, okay, well, that's great. It's a web component. I have to use their big monolithic CSS file just so I can get a button. I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to build it myself. And so I think the best teams could see beyond themselves and start to look at their design system as, in part, somewhat of an abstraction. And also, they try to think about their design system in a more modular way. If you look at Google's material design, I don't know if this was exactly their intent, but there are separate parts that you can engage with. There's the spec, there's the description of how the design system works and all of its key parts of motion and space and color and the fab button and so on. And separate from that, there's a Polymer library to build apps with. Separate from that, there's a Material Design Lite library to build sites with. Those are two separate things that if you're building a site that you want to use material design, suddenly that's your ticket. But material design at its core is not necessarily a mandated single toolkit for people to use. It's a lot bigger than that. And I think that the other thing that I've observed Salesforce writing about some is that they actually break down their design system into all its composed decisions. Essentially, they're a design system at its core is a bunch of design decisions that you break down into different property value pairs, primary color one, primary color two. How can you actually think about it in that way so that somebody building on a Windows platform can suddenly engage with the iconography, the editorial concerns, and some of your design patterns, even though they're not going to use your header component that goes on top of your website because it's wholly inappropriate in that kind of environment. So if you can break it down into those different pieces, you have a better chance for not just having other people sense the value that you can provide for them, but you take a different mindset of instead of designing just for the product you're working on, you're just myopically with those horse blinders on, you're thinking a little bit more broadly about what you're doing and the impacts it might have.
This feels like it's not something folks do on a whim. This is really a concerted, thoughtful effort that folks need to put together. If they're going to say, okay, we're doing the design system thing, this is something that really does require resources. It requires some thoughtful approach to it and really sort of looking into the future and saying, okay, what are we going to do with this and how are we going to make it work?
I think so, but that scares a lot of people. Unless you've got a design organization where it's obviously got 150 designers all going all sorts of directions and you realize you need to corral that, there's going to be a bigger investment that you're going to recognize. But most teams don't find themselves in that position. I tend to think that you start smaller and you choose the most important things that everybody has to do right and or will be most broadly applicable to everybody else. And John Wiley from Google said it best when he said, make the right thing to do the easiest thing to do. And so how can you think about your design system's core parts? Think color. Spend more time on color than you spend on the dynamic nature of some very specific widget that's important for two of your most important products, but irrelevant for everybody else. And how can you think about the way the color needs to be applied, that it's you've got accessible contrast, that you can essentially think about the range of choices and tints and shades of these colors that people are allowed to use or not? How can you show them examples of good and poor use of those colors in context because you're involved enough with those other teams to gather those things naturally? I think if you start to build from that core you'll find that starting small and building it progressively with a smaller dedicated team, or not dedicated team in terms of dedicated to the design system, but passionate about it and working across those different teams, will work better than thinking, I need a design system competency, time to hire five people, and those five people have no clue what's going on in any other product team whatsoever, because then it's a separate team that really isn't engaged, and it'll take them a lot more time to realize the value of that investment as they start to guide and facilitate everything else.
The sort of factors that push companies into going in this direction, this idea that everything we're producing feels like it's going in lots of different directions. Is there an ideal point where a team might say, now is our time to do this, or, you know, if we wait any longer, it's just going to get worse? Or is it really just, you know, you do it when you do it, and there is no good time or there is no bad time? Or
I think I can't say explicitly what the magical tipping point is. What that sort of tripwire is that some organization trips over and realizes, oh my gosh, we have to have a design system. I do think it's associated with a few different things that have happened in our industry. You have the whole designers that can code and coders that can design and this overlap in skill sets. And so one of the things we've seen is there's a mutual appreciation across those disciplines for the structure and the value that each can provide, particularly in how they overlap. And so this rise of living style guides, right? All of these different componentized manifestations of a design system in HTML and components. Brad Frost's Atomic's design system is a really strong example of that. But also the fact that people can look at Bootstrap and Foundation from Zurb and now Things from Material Design and all of these other industry examples of these component libraries and these design libraries or living style guides is now creating a sense of, wow, people are organized and they're starting to see the patterns of how they're communicated and how they're structured. Another thing is there's this big in-house design movement. And as a design agency owner, I'm acutely aware of how the competencies of user experience design and just design as a competency digitally has started to garner more and more investment. And as that happens, companies are going to get more serious about the processes and or practices that they have to make those things happen and conduct the work more efficiently and share the load across all of those different teams. And so as you think about it that way, Google and others have done really well to be public in how they're not just creating those artifacts, like Uber has a great online style guide. But Google, if you go to material design these days, there's highly polished videos that talk about all these different perspectives. I think, Jared, actually one of the things that they ask is, what is this thing called? And they all say 8 different labels for it: design system, living style guide, all these different, what they think that material design represents. But at least it's provoking other companies that what would Google do? They ask themselves that question and they can see how this organization's happening and they can start to model their own behaviors or progression of how their team's modeled to like that.
You mentioned Brad Frost and Foundation and Zurb. One of the things that I occasionally hear is, you know, particularly you hear it with Bootstrap, right? You can look at a website and you can see, oh yeah, they did that with Bootstrap. And it starts to all feel the same. There's this pushback that you sometimes hear from designers about design systems limiting the creative capability and sort of making everything look and feel the same. And how much of it is, if we're going to start our own design system, are we better off inventing some whole new style, or are we better off taking something like Material or Bootstrap and then iterating on that?
I think more often than not, companies of any particular scale of design are inventing their own design language that they use as their core. I think that there's a recognition within those companies by their design leaders that they don't want everybody conceiving of a different blue and red as their primary brand colors. And so what I've been really encouraged by is that designers are open to the fact that there are some core decisions that need to be shared by the entire organization. But at the same time, the system needs to afford them the latitude. The system needs to afford them the latitude to solve a problem in a way that's optimal for their environment. One of the examples that I share in the workshops I conduct is about iconography. And the fact of the matter is that there's a language and a particular character and tone that icons carry through that is a portion of the expression of the brand. And so as the teams adopt this, you imagine yourself having 20 different product teams that are all supported by different UX and visual designers and so on. They still can utilize a core set of icons across all their products fairly effectively until you start talking about Android, because Android and iOS have different sets of icons that carry the same meaning. And so when you're on Android, should you have an iOS-inspired icon, or should you be using something that's specific to Android? That's a question where it's obvious that the designer is going to expect to have not just autonomy, but the freedom to create an optimal solution for what they're working on. The challenge becomes in all of those other less clear parts of the system, where should they be able to shift how sign-in works? Should they be able to innovate and create a new sign-in that's based on a gesture rather than a username password pair? And so that's where innovation needs to be fairly deliberate, because something like that could be a real breakthrough, but at the same time is going to potentially cause all of the other products to start to change. But the design system isn't necessarily a hindrance for that. The design system is an enabler to help you set up all the decisions that you can essentially reuse without concern. And then you can push back on that system to either essentially change it or extend it by the work that you do as an individual designer. I think design systems can't live, can't persist. You can't sustain them unless they're willing to deal with the outside forces that cause them to change. And so if you take the concept that it's a centralized thing and you push it out to everybody else and everybody else just has to use it, then it feels like governance, then it feels like dictation, and designers will, in a sense, reject it or do what they can to work around it.
So what I hear you saying is that the system itself has to have flexibility built into it.
Yeah, it needs to be mutable in a sense. They need to be able to look at it as something that will respond to their needs. And that's why I think back to the Sun.com example in 2006. I mean, that's 9 years ago. It was still today the best component library I've ever seen. And it was all managed by primarily one person. We called him the Overlord. And he created components for a wide array of different web properties. And he had a team that worked with him to build a lot of stuff. But honestly, if you couldn't get it on his calendar, guess what? He's not going to add it to the library. And thus, you're out to lunch. You can't do anything. Well, that doesn't play anymore, particularly because it's not just all on the web. You've got all these different platforms. You have a much richer array of teams. You have a much more diverse set of products that have all their different needs. If you look at a system as an overlord that you just have to get on their clock in order to get to change it, it's not going to work. I think the systems that are more enabling and more encouraging, not just usage, but contribution, are the ones that will work really well. You need to have someone that's moderating, or a team that's moderating that contribution, making sure that the quality is sustained and that it fits in right and all of those other considerations. Everybody expects that. But if you can actually get people to contribute, that is when a system really starts to live, because then it just bleeds into everybody's work rather than feeling like this resource that you employ and then you have to extend yourself and change yourself independently.
That change from the overlord to having this more flexible, adaptable, mutable system, does that mean that you have to be better at predicting the future?
No. In almost all the engagements, at least that I've worked on, I try to discourage folks from predicting the future. A design system to me is about meeting the needs of your organization to make sure the stuff you're building now is cohesive and that you're building it as efficiently as you can. Predicting the future, in a sense, you start to get into innovation. And while there are innovations in how systems work, I'm most curious about those, of course, but in terms of innovating your product line, I believe that that innovation actually rests within the product teams themselves, those teams that are engaging in design thinking and taking the risks and prototyping and getting feedback from their user bases on a biweekly cadence. You know, that's where the innovation, I think, is going to occur more. To me, the system itself is a reflection of the collective decisions that those teams need to sustain their synchronization with, rather than where all the innovation actually happens in an org.
So that idea of sustaining and keeping track as the organization changes, this is design systems, it sounds like, are a long-term investment. These are things, what can a team sort of expect if this thing really takes off and becomes useful? What can they expect that sort of long-term investment need to be?
I think that there's a number of tangible things that probably will require investment. The first is investing in the practice by which designers share their work, try to converge on the decisions that they have. You could think of design shares. You could think of just how you have more temporal periods of intense work to move a particular portion of the experience forward. Think of putting a bunch of designers in a war room for a week. You could think also of a tangible investment in the documentation. Oh my gosh, a shutter. I can't believe I'm saying the word documentation, but that material design site is documentation. Those toolkits are in large part documentation wrapping the actual pieces that you can use over and over again. And so investing in that experience of explaining what the system is and explaining what all the different parts are that you can employ and how they relate to one another is going to be an investment. That said, I think it also depends on how it fits into each of the orgs. I worked with an organization last year who had a very significant investment in recurring design research. They were running multiple studies a week. And so the design system and all of those parts, that research team continually was investigating week after week after week. Part of the question I wanted to provoke with them was, how can you actually start to synchronize how you communicate what the decisions are, like about color, and the research you've done on those color choices and how those color choices work or don't work in different contexts? And so the investment also comes more naturally. It's not like I suddenly built a 100-hour project that I wanted to do to blend those two things together. It's more, how can I then just talk to those people to figure out how we could weave those stories together better? And I'd like to think that as the designers in an organization work within their product teams, that they're still going to be able to carve out those moments to either contribute more naturally as the system works, or they start to drift towards being committed to that system team as it begins to scale up. But I haven't seen it be much larger than a team of 3 to 5 people at its core, and then all of the sort of non-quantifiable contributions of all those other folks participating that are actually designing products themselves.
So 3 to 5 people for long-term stuff and then all the different folks. I love this idea that as research is being done, as parts of the products and services are being tested, that observations that they had about the design system elements get put back into the design system documentation so people can see not just what they should be doing, but what research has shown works and doesn't.
Yeah, I think that those are two examples of what might be a small number of enterprise-level concerns that all designers are going to care about, or at least the ones that I would be working with in an organization I'd hope they'd care about. Another one is just, what products are we working on? What are we innovating? How can you generate the visibility and the awareness across all of those different teams? The design system just becomes one of those vehicles to generate that awareness and actually bring people together. It doesn't mean that people need to become experts on every nook and cranny of the design system, but being aware of the ongoing research, being aware of the ongoing cohesive, converging design that the team has is going to be part and parcel to everybody, all the different designers' participation.
It would seem to me that it would give a nice foundation for critique too. You know, when folks are needing to deviate from the design system, you can get into the rationale and really sort of talk about that in a critique setting that would be really educational. Plus, it would really sort of help define where the design system needs to be helping and where it gets in the way.
You hit upon a really good opportunity that the design system provides, because there are structured design shares that the design system can sometimes provoke. Think a weekly session where all those key influencers of the system plus other designers are welcome to attend, but then you get these presenting designers that bring their stuff that they're working on. They might bring it once every quarter or once every 2 months or something like that. There are positive and negative things that happen there. The positive things are that everybody's seeing more design that's bubbling up throughout the organization. And they're also getting critique from all the design leaders who happen to also be the stewards of the design system. But at the same time, those conversations sometimes go south, because then the conversations become a critique of the product design's quality. And in that forum, that's not necessarily the best thing to talk about. I'm not saying that you shouldn't critique quality or try and raise the quality of an individual product, but that forum affords you the opportunity to talk about things that are relevant to all of those people, that cross-section across your enterprise. And so the conversation that I have tried to surface through those is by talking to the presenting designer a couple days before, we talk about their product. We ask, all right, what questions do you have about how you're employing the design system? Do you think you're doing really well, or do you have a new idea, or are there questions around how you are less confident about the decisions you're making? And I try to help them form the 3 to 4 questions that are, honestly, if they have a half an hour and they don't belabor the endless context to describe what their product context is, because nobody else wants to hear about that. They get really bored really fast. But instead, they show their stuff, they ask pointed questions that are relevant to the system and relevant to everybody in the room. And suddenly you're talking about the application of a tint of the shade of blue for their off-canvas menu. Should you really do that? It's kind of a muddy middle blue. And when you open up the off-canvas, suddenly you have this really big block of color that's muddy. Whereas the design system and the design language is to use vibrant, strong colors of blue and red. So everybody talks about, should you use these tints on larger blocks of the interface? And the answer was no. And so that's a relevant discussion that will keep that product cohesive with the rest of the products. You can incorporate and publish that content into the design system. Honestly, you should do it that very day. Hey, guess what? Don't do this. Here's a negative example. We've got a publishing platform that somebody just logs in, commits the chains, and suddenly you have another example. And that designer is taking back critical feedback that will both help their product be better, but also help it be more cohesive. And so balancing that product quality aspect of the critique versus the application of the design system is a tough one to do. If you're talking about both of those things, I think it's going to justify the rationale for having that, convening all those different important people for half an hour or an hour during their Thursday afternoon.
That just seems like a fantastic way, particularly when you have teams where you're always adding new people, to just constantly have the design system conversation be front and center. People who are new to it can sit back and listen to the folks who are using it really sort of take apart pieces and explore where the boundaries are, what's acceptable, what isn't, what the philosophies are, what aren't. But at the same time, it doesn't feel like, okay, today we're going to have our brown bag lunch and we're going to walk through, you know, the 17 approved ways of using color.
No, gosh, that'd be so boring. Everybody would check out. They'd come once and they'd be like, this is so stupid. I'm never coming back to this thing again. And I've seen that happen. It's really unfortunate. If you refactor how you're marketing that kind of event, that you've got a person coming in, they've already prepared their 2 to 4 key questions they want to ask. You put that in the actual announcement of the program that day that people will look at a few hours earlier to decide if it's relevant for them. And it's also an event like that manifests the values of the organization in terms of how they think about the design system and whether or not they consider it something that everybody should transparently be able to see. If you get all those leaders together, they're demonstrating their commitment by attending. And they're also in the open, critiquing and honestly still problem solving how the design system should work. The design system is not this fixed thing, this decided array of design choices that everybody should just use. It's malleable, it's mutable, it's going to need to change, it's going to need to evolve, because guess what? Maybe that off canvas should use a muddier but more neutral color. Oh, wow, now we should think about how we're using neutral colors differently. And if you do that in the open, you do that transparently, it's going to be a lot more engaging for others to see and then be able to express their own voice eventually, rather than feeling like that product review is like a gated design review near the end of your project when you need to go in front of the design review board and have them tear apart all the design decisions that you made inconsistent with the system, which is the wrong way to go.
Nathan, this has been fantastic. I think that this workshop is going to be so informative, and people are going to be able to really get a solid understanding as to how to get started and how to build up a really useful, flexible, and most importantly, contributory design system into the organization that brings the level of cohesion across the design, but at the same time helps the team become smarter about design just by talking about it. It's really exciting.
Indeed, I'm looking forward to it.
So if you guys want to come to Nathan's workshop, it's going to be on November 2nd. It's part of the User Interface 20 conference, and you can find out more information about it at uiconf.com. His workshop is called Building Scalable Design Systems and Style Guides, and it's going to be in Boston. And very excited. I'm expecting that this session is going to be extremely popular, so if you're thinking of coming, you want to sign up early. Nathan, thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It was a lot of fun.
And I want to thank our audience once again for talking to us. And as always, thanks for encouraging our behavior. Take care.
For more information about Nathan's and the other 7 workshops, visit uiconf.com. That's UICONF.com. As always, thanks for listening.